This is KGNU's Morning Magazine. It's Tuesday, December 7th, Colorado Gives Day. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's program, we kick off a new collaborative series with Rocky Mountain Community Radio, this time looking at how the region is transitioning away from fossil fuels. We hear from a woman who wants the state to replace air quality monitors for a fracking site next to her son's elementary school in Greeley. Is a snowless future a possibility in the West? That story and more in This Week in Water. And we'll play our weekly comment line. At the bottom of the hour, we'll go to the BBC News headlines. Then it's How on Earth? On this week's KGNU Science Show, naturalists search for winter wildlife. Then former Denverite and now Harvard medical doctor and author Howard Weiner talks about his new book, The Brain Under Siege. At 9 a.m., it's the wit and wisdom of Alan Watts, the British philosopher, writer, and speaker known for interpreting Eastern religious ideas for a Western audience. Then at 9:30, James Wise will be in the Boulder studio for the Morning Sound Alternative. But first, it's time for local and regional headlines with KGNU's Stacey Johnson.
A vaccine mandate for employees of the City of Boulder takes effect today at 5 p.m. Under the mandate, city employees are required to submit a proof of vaccination or request an exemption. According to a city spokesperson, so far fewer than 100 employees have requested a religious or medical exemption. To encourage compliance, the city is paying vaccinated employees a $250 bonus. A state audit report found the Department of Labor and Employment may have potentially paid just over $73 million in fraudulent unemployment claims spanning between March 1, 2020 to April 30th of this year. The amount is separate from the $30 million the department has previously confirmed as improperly paid. The Legislative Audit Committee met yesterday to hear the auditor's findings and responses from department officials. The potential fraud identified includes unemployment to dead people, inmates, underage applicants, claimants with multiple fraud indicators, and claimants with suspicious bank account information. The audit noted three major contributors to the potential fraud, which include expedited payments mandated by the governor's March 2020 executive order, federal pandemic requirements such as unemployment for gig workers, and the department's delay in moving to an efficient computer system. Colorado's Office of eHealth Innovation releases updated health information technology roadmap. KGNU's Steve Miller has more.
The new state objectives are in place to improve the information technology digital tools and technologies that addresses the gaps in the state's health care system. Lieutenant Governor Diane Primavera told Colorado Newsline that the idea is to identify accessibility and to saving people money on health care. Primavera said that during the pandemic, the gap between the haves and the have-nots in the healthcare system were highlighted. For example, it was found that the use of telemedicine decreased as the patient's age increased. Also pointed out was that Black and Asian people had lower rates of telemedicine than white people. And she added that advanced health IT can have a significant impact on efforts like reaching the unvaccinated population. In the updated plan, a more comprehensive healthcare IT system would allow doctors to access patient records from previous providers, which would prevent duplicate testing and medical visits. Potential funding for health IT infrastructure could come from Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, the American Rescue Plan Act, and the recently passed infrastructure bill. I'm Steve Miller for KGNU.
Economists at the University of Colorado Leeds School of Business predict robust job growth next year, with many sectors returning to pre-pandemic levels. That's according to the school's annual business and economic forecast released yesterday at a forum in Denver. The one sector that is not expected to recover in 2022 is leisure and hospitality, with employment remaining well below 2019 levels. The sector includes performing arts, entertainment, sports, recreation, and food services. Forecasters also predict tourism spending will not return to 2019 levels for another 2 or 3 years. According to the Leeds faculty director, what bodes well for Colorado is the state has the fourth highest labor force participation rate in the country. The state demographer, Elizabeth Garner, said during the forum, estimates for 2021 show it was the slowest population growth year for Colorado in three decades. Garner blamed slow domestic migration and almost zero international migration as reasons for the state's slow population growth. The Denver City Council has approved the issuance of $700 million in bonds to the Denver International Airport. The 10-1 vote occurred last evening with Councilperson Candy Sitabaca voting no without comment and Councilperson Chris Herndon absent. The Denver Gazette reports the bonds will be interim notes used to finance remaining projects under the airport's 2018 to 2022 capital improvement program. Slated spending priorities include gate expansion and phases 1 and 2 of the Great Hall project. The Denver City Council has also approved a ban on the sale of most flavored tobacco products. The measure passed yesterday evening by an 8-3 vote. The ban will take effect July 1, 2023, and includes flavored menthol cigarettes, chewing tobacco, and vaping products. An exemption exists for hookah, natural cigars, pipe tobacco, and harm reduction tools. According to the Denver Gazette, the ban was first introduced in October to curb youth tobacco use, particularly with vaping. Today's weather includes mostly cloudy skies, then gradually becoming clear for Denver and Boulder with a high near 50. Fort Collins will have mostly sunny skies with a high near 47. Tonight will be mostly clear with a low of 30 for Denver and Boulder and 25 for Fort Collins. Current temps are nearing 32 degrees. For KGNU, I'm Stacy Johnson.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. Today, we kick off a new collaboration with our sister stations in the Rocky Mountain Community Radio Network. This time, we'll look at the transition away from fossil fuels across the Mountain West. Construction started in South Central Wyoming back in 2016 on what will be the country's largest wind farm. The project is unusual because of its size and also because it's located on federal land. But a federal agency is also stalling a key aspect of its development. Kyle Mackey from KHOL in Jackson reports.
Jason Thiesfeld is driving a white pickup truck over a network of newly built dirt roads winding through sagebrush and native grasses. The landscape is almost a textbook definition of the wide open spaces Wyoming is famous for.
Think about it. I mean, last year there was not a road through here. It was almost, you'd almost have to ride a horse and to get across this country. And I just passed my turn. See, there's so many new roads, I can't even remember where I'm going. But and now it's just this nice.
Thiesfeld is site coordinator of the Choke Cherry and Sierra Madre Wind Energy Project for the Power Company of Wyoming. He's been working on the 320,000-acre project site near Rawlins for almost 15 years, even before construction started. That's because this project required more environmental analysis than your average wind farm.
We know everything about the site, the wind, the vegetation, the habitat, the wildlife, where things live, where things move, where the wind blows. It's a huge science project, really.
Kara Choquette is the company's communications director. She says the Choke Cherry and Sierra Madre project is probably one of the most scrutinized wind farms in the country because of its location on Bureau of Land Management, or BLM, land.
It's just a fact that when you are doing energy projects on federal land, there's more environmental review, more environmental scrutiny, therefore more time, more costs. And that's just how it is.
We're probably 97 to 98% located on private lands across the country, and that can't remain the same.
Tom Darren is Senior Director of Western State Affairs for the American Clean Power Association, the largest wind trade association in North America.
We need to tap in to the great wind and solar resources that are on our public lands in the Western United States.
That's because Congress set an ambitious goal last year of permitting 25 gigawatts of renewable energy projects on public lands by 2025. The current capacity of permitted projects is about 12 gigawatts, according to the BLM. The Chokecherry and Sierra Madre site will generate at least 3,000 megawatts of clean electricity once it's completed. But another federal agency is standing in the way of how that electricity will reach customers via the planned Transwest Express transmission line.
I guess it's disappointing that there was so much collaboration to develop the route for the project. The Transwest project was designated a Rapid Response Team federal priority transmission project by the Obama administration 10 years ago. And the last mile and the last obstacle is a federal agency.
The LA Times reported in August that the last private landowner blocking the construction path for Transwest is Cross Mountain Ranch in northwest Colorado. The family is backed by the Natural Resources Conservation Service, part of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Basically, the BLM approved a path for Transwest across part of the ranch in 2013. But then in 2014, the NRCS approved conservation easements in the same area that specifically prohibited the construction of transmission lines.
In this area, there is no conflict except the one that the NRCS created. The Transwest project would cross the conservation easement on land that is not great sage-grouse habitat. So it's a 16,000-acre conservation easement. The project needs 30 acres alongside a state highway.
Choquette says the company had no choice but to file a lawsuit against the USDA in 2019. That's still playing out, but she's hoping for a decision soon, and preferably long before the first of about 900 wind turbines start going up on the site in 2025 or 2026. For KHOL and Rocky Mountain Community Radio, I'm Kyle Mackey.
On Saturday, protesters marched outside of Governor Jared Polis's downtown Boulder residence to protest the state's decision to take down air quality monitors at a fracking site next door to Bella Romero, a public school in Greeley. Alexis Kenyon spoke with the event's organizers.
Hey, hey! Ho, ho!
Despite protests from the community, in 2017, Extraction Oil built 24 fracking wells next door to Bella Romero, an 80% Latino elementary school in Greeley. Patricia Garcia Nelson, who helped organize Saturday's protest, says her 8-year-old son was set to start Bella Romero this fall.
We are here because on October 26th of this year, I asked the governor and the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment to return the air monitors back at Bella Romero Academy. They had oil wells installed in 2018. As of right now, permits did expire for 13 of the wells, so there is a well site of 11 wells that is actively fracking right now as we speak.
This is in Greeley?
Yes.
Like right behind your kid's school?
Yes.
And there are no regulations against how close wells can be to schools?
And see, I sense your confusion, because who in their right mind would put an industrial site next to a school? So because of instances like Bella Romero and cases like Bella Romero, the state has changed the rules to put well sites a little bit further. But at the end of the day, we still have a fracking site right next to our school. And that's completely unacceptable, especially when we know there are so many studies even today that show that the communities most impacted are communities that look like mine. We're low income, marginalized. Some of our households are mixed status household. We're a community of refugees, and enough is enough. And we're going to be coming back, and we're going to keep telling the story of Bella Romero, because if we stop talking about Bella Romero, they're going to forget about us, and they're going to ignore the atrocities that the state has allowed to happen.
Why did they remove the air monitors?
The state said that they removed the air monitors for repairs, but that they would not bring them back because the instances of emissions were rare and infrequent. But in 2019, it was found that they were leaking, and we've shown that there have been over 200 instances of high emissions of toxic chemicals, including benzene. So obviously, it's happening more often. And so we are fighting to get the air monitors back, because time and time again, we've been told that things like these aren't happening, but we can't prove it without the data. And so we need the air monitor to be able to collect the data.
Do you know if any of the kids who go to school come down with asthma or that kind of stuff more frequently? I mean, obviously it's correlative.
Yeah, that is one of the major concerns is the health impacts. We're not even going to know about it for years. I've spoken with medical professionals that have said there are no tests to show that the symptoms you're experiencing are because of benzene exposure. It's not going to be until these children have been exposed constantly for years that we're going to see anything. But by that point, it's going to be too late because the wells are not just right next to the school. They're right next to the community pool. They're right next to the football field where we have hundreds of children recreating every single day.
Have you gotten any response from the government or from officials or anyone?
I have not received any response to the letter that I sent in October. I haven't even received any response acknowledging that they received my letter, but I know from people that they did, in fact, receive my letter. They're just ignoring me at this point. And so I'm here with the support of my friends and my community because they can ignore me, but they can't ignore an entire community that's asking for justice to be done.
Would you have the option of sending your kid to a different school?
Yeah. So when they removed the air monitors in March, I decided to move my family because I can't send my son to a school knowing what I know and knowing what could happen or what has been happening. And so I'm still here today fighting this fight because my sister's kids still go to the school. My cousin's kids still go to the school. You know, I have so many friends and family whose children still go to the school. And we're going to keep fighting because what is happening is not only if it's allowed to happen in my community, what's going to stop it from happening in other communities as well.
Trisha, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
I hear the voice of my great-granddaughter saying keep it in the ground.
Time now for the latest edition of This Week in Water with Jamie Sudler and Franny Halperin.
Are snowless futures a possibility in the West? That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Latest data show that snow for this time of year in much of the West is below normal, and even across the country as a whole, snow cover last week was at its lowest level since records began in 2003.
Snowpack in western mountain ranges provides much more than winter recreation. It acts like a reservoir, capturing and holding water for cities and agriculture.
Now scientists at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory are warning that warmer temperatures could lead to low and even no snow.
Their study concludes that as early as mid-century, western mountain regions could be snowless for years at a time if greenhouse gases continue to fuel climate change. Instead, they say rain will fall, but rainfall runs off or evaporates and doesn't infiltrate the ground as snow does.
James Eklund, former director of the Colorado Water Conservation Board, told the Washington Post that there's an existential threat to the West. And not all water managers are approaching the issue with the urgency it requires.
One of the researchers told the Arizona Republic that a snowless future is not set in stone, as there's ample time to mitigate carbon emissions.
Sometimes being in first place is nothing to cheer about. Last week, a report from the National Academies of Sciences said the United States generated more plastic waste than any other country in the world, despite having only about 4% of the global population.
Much of the plastic ends up in the world's oceans, the equivalent of dumping a garbage truck's worth every minute.
The report found only a fraction of plastic in the U.S. is recycled and called current infrastructure grossly insufficient to manage the complexity and quantity of the problem.
The study, which was ordered by Congress, recommends a new national strategy by the end of next year to reduce plastic pollution, particularly for items not reusable or recyclable. It also calls for alternative materials and better standards for waste collection and capture.
The demand for lithium to be used in car and phone batteries and other applications is expected to grow immensely in the next decade.
The U.S. has one of the largest reserves of the mineral in the world, but is not currently a major producer. Most lithium comes from Australia, South America, and China.
One source of the mineral is the hot, briny water about 8,000 feet underneath the Salton Sea in Southern California. Already, companies are using this water to generate geothermal electricity.
The water contains many minerals in addition to lithium and is very salty. Usually, after generating power, it's pumped back into the ground, and the scientists say they're looking for ways to extract it in an environmentally friendly manner.
A report from the Berkeley Lab says that there are technical challenges to getting the lithium. However, a company called Controlled Thermal Resources announced last month it is beginning to drill under the Salton Sea and plans to produce both electricity and lithium in about 2 years.
The company has joined with a startup backed by Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos to extract the lithium, and according to reports, the process is nearly carbon neutral and has what they claim is a net zero impact on the environment. And finally, the European eel is one of the most fascinating fish you've perhaps never heard of. In an amazing life cycle, the eels start out as larvae in the Sargasso Sea of the Western Atlantic and drift across the ocean to Europe, where they mature and swim up rivers to live.
In one of the most mysterious wildlife migrations on Earth, after about 15 years and growing to nearly 52 inches long, the eels head back across the ocean to the Sargasso, where they spawn and die.
In recent decades, European eel populations, which are critical parts of freshwater food webs, have declined by more than 95%. Most studies blame changes in ocean currents due to global warming, habitat loss, pollution, and barriers like dams, as well as international trade to Asia, where eels are a delicacy.
But starting in 2007, the European Union instituted management guidelines to ensure that at least 40% of eels were able to make it back to the sea. Programs included improving habitats, banning exports, and even pausing hydroelectric turbines when the eels were most active.
The program results have been encouraging, and recent eel numbers have increased slightly. However, restoring the historic populations will take decades of continued effort, so research organizations are calling for more action. They say just as the EU developed its Green Deal to tackle climate change, there should be an eel deal to protect their river and ocean habitats.
That's it for this week in water, and here's our deal. You're hearing our reporting because of support from listeners. Visit h2oradio.org and thank you.
And now we check in with KGNU's Comment Line.
Hi, this is Evan Rabbit. Maeve Conran hosted an interesting conversation about how to deal with misinformation. They talked about trusted sources, including the government. It's no wonder that people are confused and spreading misinformation when, in the words of the late great journalist I.F. Stone, quote, all governments lie. Here's an important current example. We hear from government folks that there's no evidence that ivermectin works against COVID-19. But a nurse directed me to a National Institute of Health published study titled, quote, Ivermectin for Prevention and Treatment of COVID-19 Infection, which is a systematic review of 144 cited studies. This review is easy to find. Just Google NIH ivermectin, and it comes up as the second result for me. Here's their conclusion. Quote, moderate certainty evidence finds that large reductions in COVID-19 deaths are possible using ivermectin. Using ivermectin early in the clinical course may reduce numbers progressing to severe disease. The apparent safety and low cost suggests that ivermectin is likely to have a significant impact on the SARS-CoV-2 pandemic globally. But on the other side of misinformation is RFK Jr., whose book, The Real Anthony Fauci, has been number one on Amazon on and off for the 2 weeks it's been published. In an article of his, he states, quote, government researchers found that 2.6% of vaccination resulted in injuries. But when I went to the source he cited, those injuries were actually, quote, possible reactions. I emailed him to ask about the discrepancy and received no reply. When both the government and its opponent, a famous, successful environmental lawyer, are both misrepresenting facts, who do you trust?
If you'd like to make a comment on something you heard on KGNU, you can leave a message at our listener comment line at 303-447-9911. We play the messages back on Tuesday mornings at 8:25. Before we go, a quick look at what's coming up on tonight's Hemispheres. Host Elena Claver will spend the hour with a panel of guests to discuss the longstanding and ongoing issue of missing and murdered young women in Ciudad Juarez and Chihuahua.
I represent and I'm part of the collective Hijas de su Maquiladora Madre. We are a group of women of all ages and all professions. Some of them are students, some of them are professional women. They're all a feminist movement and anti-capitalist movement. And we just continue to work with the mothers and some of the fathers of all these women and children that have been lost.
That's coming up tonight on Hemispheres at 6 p.m., right here on KGNU, Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. And that's all the time we have for today's Morning Magazine. I've been your host, Shannon Young.